Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 10th, 2004. Today's session number is MES-2004-05. Today's speakers are Sonia Myers and Norma Crumweed. The lesson for today is Called to be Family, but what does that mean? Families experiencing grace at the end of life. Let's listen in.
General information about families, and then went into family values. And yesterday I had long conversations about family and how they deal with the cancer experience. And today we're going to deal with families at the end of life. And we'll have a lot of time to jump in and share different stories, so feel free to do that whenever the Spirit moves you. And my name is Norma Crumweedy, and I'm one of the faculty who are teaching.
And I'm Sonia Myers, and we're both nurses and nursing faculty people at Minnesota State University, Mankato, in Minnesota, southern Minnesota, about 2 hours south, 90 minutes, south of the Twin Cities. And my background is pediatrics and child health, adult health care, and I teach family nursing at the graduate level, and then the family nurse practitioner program, which I direct as well. So.
We'll take you through a lot of different types of deaths. There's untimely deaths, there's timely deaths, sometimes there's planned deaths and suicide or taking somebody off of a ventilator. Sometimes there is real scary, traumatic deaths, like in murders. Sometimes there is deaths that are connected to long-term illnesses, so hopefully you can kind of, we'll cover quite a few of those different types of deaths. And really trying to figure out how does the grace of God play into death, because death is a very mysterious thing to all of us, so hopefully with some of the stories we share, it might bring some ideas to you as you think about your own mortality and think back about the mortality of people who have already died in your family. Sometimes you can bring meaning and hope into your life by taking a look at the memories of the people who have passed on before you.
And the other thing is kind of as part of what we're going to talk about today, we're going to also talk about some family strategies that families utilize to enhance their sense of grace at the end of life. So.
Good. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 4, I'll read that for you here. Is there are different kinds of spiritual gifts, but the same Spirit, but there are different forms of service, but the same Lord. There are different workings, but the same God who produces all of them in everyone. And as an oncology nurse, many people ask me, ooh, how can you do oncology? How can you stand always working with people who are dying? Isn't it depressing? Well, granted, not everybody can do that, because you really have to be able to hang in there and be present with people in that dying experience. And I look back in my nursing career, and probably the most pivotal person was an AIDS patient. When I graduated from nursing training, AIDS didn't even exist, and that wasn't even a thought. So working on the floors with a brand new AIDS patient for the very first time, I went in and just sat down by his bedside, just like I do with anybody else. And he told me that I was the first one in 2 weeks of his hospitalization that had sat down and spent any time with him. And so that was a pivotal point in me being able to not look at that situation as a depressing type of situation, but really being able to make a difference when you can stay in the presence of someone. And sometimes it's difficult when it's your loved one, a friend or a family member, but if you can just hold tight and stay with and be with that person, it makes a big difference. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 10 through 11. As each one has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. Whoever preaches, let it be with the words of God. Whoever serves, Let it be with the strength that God supplies, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. So my gifts, I guess, as we are kind of summoning those out this week, are really to stay present and be engaged in those difficult situations. And sometimes when you feel the most helpless, that's when you're doing some of the best things. So sometimes when you feel like you want to run away from the situation, just hold tight and stay there. End of life has a negative connotation for healthcare professionals. That's why a lot of people in healthcare aren't very good about dealing with end of life issues, because they see it as a failure. The physicians are really housed in the perspective of curing people. So whenever a cure isn't obtained and death ensues, they see that as a failure. So sometimes the multiple failures or deaths that a physician experiences also becomes traumatic for them as well. When we read this 1 Peter verse, it reminded us that of God's vessel. And I don't know if very many of you are familiar with this, but there's a little reading about God's vessel. Vessels hold all kinds of blessed things, food and drink to nourish the body, candles and perfumes to nourish the spirit, the light of Christ to nourish your soul. Vessels are treasured when empty, and they can be filled. Vessels are precious when full, and they can be emptied. Vessels may break. They can be mended, often for the sealing of the break. And families are called to be God's vessels at the end of life, because families, too, can be emptied, waiting for the fullness of His love to re-enter. They can be full, awaiting for the emptiness of self-giving, as waiting for the patient to die. To be broken in the service of the sick, and to be stronger for the healing of the wound. There seems to be three main sets of skills for families that they can focus on as their loved one is going through the end of life or that dying process. And the one that works best for people of faith and families of faith is really to look at that transcendent, whoever your creator is or your central focus of power. It really helps you to gain meaning in your life. Sharing the stories with the person who is dying or with each other is very important. And Britta, will you read Psalms 121?
To the hills, from where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. He who keeps Israel will not slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper, and the Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in, from this time on and forevermore.
And we find that families who are entering into this dying process with someone really appreciate being cared for by somebody who is spiritually rooted. And it doesn't have to be the same religion or anything, but if they have that sense of themselves as being a caregiver, it really helps in that dying process.
As a nurse, can you guys get into any kind of trouble, say praying with a patient or anything? I'm just thinking like how teachers can get in trouble in a public setting if they were to pray with students. Is that kind of thing?
Typically you can, I do it two ways. Typically you've worked, and when you're going into the death and dying process, it's a very intimate experience between nurse and patient and families, and so a lot of times you offer, would you like to pray, or would you like to have me pray with you? And sometimes you don't even have to offer. Somebody in the family might start, and then you can feel free to join in. And sometimes when you even know that they're not a spiritual family, you can just pray without them even, not even allowed, you can just pray for them when you're at your desk or or elsewhere.
But to get in trouble, no. I mean, I've never worked in a situation where that's not blessed, really. And I think healthcare, in my estimation, I was grounded at Lutheran Deaconess School of Nursing, which was a 3-year diploma program, and we sang hymns every morning and prayed with all of our patients. That was part of our education. I mean, the whole spirituality education was a part of it. Norma was at Augustana, you know, similar kinds of experiences. And the healthcare facilities where I, all of them where I have worked, it is a very open kind of experience where that, because we know that health is all about physical, emotional, and spiritual health, all kind of woven together. So really no difference. And I've been at the bedside many times when the surgeon says to the family, would you like to pray together? And we do. We all do together. So so it's a really important part of, and we, you know, we're part of when the clergy are there and the chaplains might be all part of it. Yes.
When you talk about spiritual grounding, you know, I think it really sometimes, you know, can go beyond prayer. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
But there's a certain kind of, you know, holy presence.
Yeah.
When my mom was dying, you know, I was the pastor, so there was like nobody. I kept waiting for the pastor to come.
Uh-huh.
And when I finally realized, you know, that it was the oncology nurse, you know, who could tell me certain things like, you know, I know that your mom's in some pain, but, you know, she's got life-ending work to do. You don't want to knock her out just yet.
Yeah.
You know, things like that that were really important for me.
Uh-huh.
Or even the guy who set up the bed, you know, when we had to set up the hospital bed in the living room. You know, just the way he did it, he didn't pray with me.
Uh-huh.
But he acted like it mattered, and he just kind of had a steady presence about him that, you know, this was okay. He didn't just come in and rattle all the, you know, metalware and, you know, get that thing set up and get out of there.
Yeah.
You know, he just was kind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those are the people that can bring that holy presence to us, even sometimes without a word.
Yeah. Thank you. That's very true. I mean, I think Norma and I have both been in situations where it is a holy moment. I mean, those are very holy moments that we experience, and you can't plan them. There's no book that will prepare you for them, and it is a mystical, magical kind of experience that you can only understand by having been there. And we have a lot of clergy in the group, I suspect, who have been there. Also, at the end of life, are you willing to reveal yourselves, you clergy? I'm like, I want, or three that I know. There might be some folks back there as well. So, what we're saying as nurses, I know that you've experienced also as clergy. So,
yeah. It is a very sacred time that you have to uphold, and when you're talking about the presence, even just how people use touch.
Mm-hmm.
In that moment really makes the impact as well.
Sorry to keep asking.
That's
okay. Have you dealt with, I'm sure you have dealt with people of other religions and stuff, and how do you see it? What kind of differences have you noticed there?
I work a lot with the Native Americans when I lived in Montana, and they have their own way of being in their shaman or their healers. And so even though you're providing your regular care, there's a sweet grass that you have to keep on this side of the bed, and I was taking care of a chief, so then he had his own flag that needed to be draped in a certain manner, and you allow those like cedar smudgings and burnings and those things to occur, and it's very different because not all the nurses like that. They don't like to put that extra effort into making sure that you're maintaining whatever the person's spiritual beliefs or religions are, because when the Native American person is dying, you know, you have probably about 75 or 100 people in your hospital, so you have the waiting room full and just trying to manage that, because they want to ensure that the person will have a good crossing over, so that by having everybody's presence, it helps with that transition.
Mm-hmm. And I have had similar experiences with families of Buddhist background, and we have a variety of experiences with different cultures, but I remember one specific family where part of the ritual is that the family bathes the person after death. First of all, they all have to be present there at that time. But the family bathes the person not after death, but just before death, and as closely as you can estimate it as a nurse and physicians how this is all going to work, and that part's a challenge. But so that they're clean, and then they're dressed in their finest to cross over, which is very different than what our experience might be as our, you know, our culture. But that is so incredibly important to them. So that's what we did. And then, you know, in a variety of cultures, elders make the decision about to not to resuscitate, or, you know, whatever. So there may, as we're talking about family care, of course, families are rooted in their culture, whatever that is, and religious tradition as well as ethnic cultures. And working with the family means working with all of that, working with all of that to make certain that the family maintains that sense of integrity as it is already.
Does working with, I know in the Mankato area, there's quite a number of Somalis with mm-hmm. Muslim background, where gender becomes an issue where a nurse may not be able to care for somebody, or mm-hmm. have you had to deal with that at all? I know we talked about that at our clergy gathering, that there are issues there in terms of modesty that mm-hmm. certain genders can deal with other genders yeah. in certain settings.
I actually don't have any experience at the end of life. My experience with Somali families is at the beginning of life, when the decisions for the laboring mother are made by the male, and that creates some interesting dynamics. But my experience with Muslim culture, it was more in the Rochester area when I was there as a nurse, and we had, you know, there were male attendants who worked with the male members of the family through the nurse, who would supply things and supplies and suggest pain management and all of that kind of thing, but a male attendant was with the individual. So I don't have direct experience at the end of life.
The thing that's kind of tricky sometimes with different cultural groups is discussing whether to resuscitate and do CPR for them at the end of life, and for organ donation and procurement, because with most Caucasian European people, you can talk about those things straight away, and everybody has their independent thoughts as to what they want done, if they want to be resuscitated, not resuscitated, if they want any organs donated. But there's certain cultural groups, like the Native Americans, asking them whether they want to be resuscitated or not is not an option. They want you to do whatever you possibly can for them, because it is an experience of life. So none of those people are not resuscitated. Whereas the Latino population typically will not allow any of their organs to be donated or procured, because they need those as they believe in the afterlife, they need those to be a whole person. So you'll have some people with diabetes who could probably live 20 some years if they would have a leg amputated or something, and sometimes they will refuse to do that if they are really sticking to those old traditional values and beliefs. So that becomes kind of confusing. And it's confusing even within a group. So even within the Native American population that I talk about, you have very traditional Native Americans, you have these transitional Native Americans, and you have some really modern people who really assimilated into the white world, as they refer to it. So even within a group, it's hard to generalize. You really have to have deep discussions with each one to make sure you're trying to provide the best care at the end of life.
And the only way we can do that is the typical thing that we talk about in Holden a lot. The only way to do that is interact. And so we, as healthcare providers, need to intentionally interact with individuals so that we can be sharing those kinds of things in a way that's meaningful to them.
Yeah, that's really trying to pull out what is the meaning of the suffering to that person or to that family, because they can give you a lot of hints as to how best to help them if you can get them to share their own stories of past, people who have passed on, and that's helpful. So that transcendence is the first one that's really important that we've been talking about. The second one is to enable some hope. And a lot of times this comes as you're sharing different experiences. If you've heard how they've surmounted other challenges in their life. And hope is really not something that's always in the future. Sometimes at the end of life, hope is in what their past life has been. So by telling stories of their life and having some life closure or some life review as to what their meaning of their life is, it helps to instill hope. But sometimes I've taken care of bums who have been riding the rails for most of their life. I remember taking care of a Vietnam vet who was a hobo, as we called him, as he rode the rails. And he had not very much to share, and he had very little hope. But even the ability to show his now daughter, who was present with him, which they had been estranged all these years, just how to die. That was it. Mm-hmm. That was the thing that he had left that he could give. So just being able to help him, help her, kind of mend some of those things at the end is very difficult sometimes. But it helps to enable hope in that family unit. There's a reading in the Bible on Romans 5, 1 through 5. Therefore, since we are justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have obtained access to this grace in which we stand. And we boast in our hope of sharing the glory of God. And not only that, but we also boast in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. Does anybody have a story they'd like to share about hope at the end of life?
Yes.
Just a continuation of my comments yesterday.
Sure.
When I was first diagnosed with cancer about 7 years ago, and the doctor told me I had 3 to 5 years to live. Mm-hmm. Because I did not have to go into treatment right away, I decided not to tell anybody with the exception of 8-10 people. And one of the people I told, of course, was my pastor. And we were sitting in his office and talking, and he could tell, you know, my emotion and things like this. And he made a statement, and he said, "This seems to be bothering you." And it was a statement out of the blue that struck me. It struck me oddly at that time. Mm-hmm. And we didn't explore that statement at that time. But Jim had only been our pastor for about a year and a half, and I was just getting to know him. And as I got to know him the last 6-7 years now, he's not afraid of death. His faith And that's what he was talking about and what he was trying to share with me. And I didn't catch it at the time, mm-hmm. but as knowing him now, I understand what he meant.
That's a very important lesson because learning to be comfortable with that is quite a trick. So he has some solid background, so he does feel very comfortable mm-hmm. in that, in his own mortality and helping other people through that as well. So you can gain some strength from your pastor. That was good. Thanks for sharing that. At Jewish funerals, I have some Jewish friends. It's very odd to me because I'm not Jewish, but what they say during their funeral is, "May his memory be for a blessing." And it's always said at Jewish funerals, and it used to bother me when they said that phrase because I thought, well, what does this have to do, and how is this helpful to the family at the end of life? But now, as I'm getting older, I now have a little bit more of appreciation for that because they see that as when the person dies, it really is a blessing because they see that the afterlife is so much better than what the real life is. And it is that ability to take that whole life experience and then share that. It's a blessing to be able to tell those stories at the funerals or life celebrations or whatever you want to call them at the end of life. So.
One thing, and I've been thinking about too, is, you know, maybe to, you know, have some sort of sign of hope, something that you can touch or see. For my mom, when she was diagnosed with the cancer, I had gotten this pendant, and it was just like blown glass, but it had like this Star Wars material in it mm-hmm. that when the light hit it in a certain way would shine, and it shone out in this teal color that she just really loved. And so when she was diagnosed, I gave it to her and called it her glowing heart of hope. And she wore it to, you know, she wore it all the time. And but, you know, it also broke at a couple critical moments. I mean, fell and we had to glue it actually together a couple of times. Once at her biopsy, and once then when she had gone for her like follow-up, and you know, and it turned out that the cancer had actually spread. Uh-huh. And at that point too, it fell and broke.
Isn't that interesting?
And then and then we didn't do anything about it. We just kind of left it in a little pouch, uh-huh. you know, for a couple, you know, while we were like sort of catching our breath. And then one day she said, you know, we really need to glue, you know, this thing together. And it was like just like the night before my brothers and sisters came because I had called them. Uh-huh. And then when she died, I set the glass piece in her cremation uh-huh. box, kind of on the top of it, because when we had been gluing it the last night, that night, she asked me if I'd ever given up hope. Mm-hmm. And, you know, frankly, I didn't have any hope of her survival, mm-hmm. you know, but I was able to tell her that no, hope was alive for her, you know. So I think, too, part of the way we think about hope, and then, you know, but it was very meaningful for us to have that symbol of hope that yeah. we could look at and touch and carry us through the experience. And yeah. you know, I'm thinking that might be something that is you or other families that you know go through something yeah. like that to maybe be able to find a symbol yeah. like that.
So by when you say you're able to never give up hope for her, mm-hmm. You don't mean in her surviving, but in like her passing or right. her life afterwards?
Right, and her life mm-hmm. her life in God.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and that no matter how many times it fell to the ground and shattered, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, we could hold on to hope of the resurrection.
Of course.
You know, hope of life, hope yeah. of, you know, and that's the thing that glows for us yeah. as people.
You know, you make a good point, and I won't forget okay. about you. You make a good point in that earlier in the week, our second day, we were talking about the importance of family time, and part of how we get family time is within ritual. And I think that's, you're kind of really demonstrating an important kind of a ritual, that it's a ritual at the end of life that may be very different than, giving the cross of baptism. Well, this is a different way in which to create a ritual around death, around hope of a different kind.
Yeah. Remember when we had a colleague who died from breast cancer, mm-hmm. recurrence, and all through that struggle, and we as a faculty ended up wearing purple bracelets. And we all had purple bracelets, so we all had that ability to experience that. And still I see some people pull them out.
Yeah.
And they'll be wearing them, even though she's died about 3 years mm-hmm. ago. But people use that, and some people, every family member has the same pendant mm-hmm. that they will wear through that experience to keep them in, kind of in them, keep it in their mind, and then help them share across the family. And sometimes people have like little tokens in their pocket, or those punched out pennies that you have with a cross or whatever that you want to use as your symbol. So those are all other strategies.
Yeah.
You were talking, you mentioned, my mother died of cancer, also breast cancer. And she lived for 10 years with it, and she almost, from the time she got it, till 7 years later, we all thought she was going to die, and new chemotherapy and radiation pulled her through, and she lived another 3 years. But at the end, when there was no more hope, for her survival, she was in a nursing home at the very end, and my sister and I were the only two. There were seven children in the family, and my sister and I were the only two who were there at the very end. And we're both very strong in our faith, and so was she. So we knew she was dying. I mean, this was the end. And yet we knew that there was hope in something else. So we just started reading the Psalms. And we didn't know what to do. There was no pastor, there was no one to lead us. But we just picked up something and just started reading, knowing that it was almost the end. And she was going to die within, minutes probably. And so that was the hope. It wasn't the hope of life anymore, but there was a hope of the faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Psalms are, I've heard many, 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 many readings of the Psalms, and in hospital rooms and in homes and in nursing homes, and there is just something like salve about the Psalms. 121, 23, sometimes people have a favorite Psalm that they are reading, and so, and that in itself is your faith ritual. A way in which you are demonstrating the comfort that comes through that for you as a family. So, when my dad died, my big strapping brother is a wonderful man of faith, and that's what he said. Okay, let's get the Bibles out. So that's what we did. It was good.
Yeah, it was good. It was helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else have anything they want to say about hope? The third thing that we wanted to cover was the ability to establish a connection. So we kind of stumbled into that already and how important that is, even during that end-of-life process, but even afterwards, because when you're sharing your memories and you can really see how all of you have this connection still, even though the death has occurred way in the past.
Yeah, well, when Norma and I were talking a little bit about preparing for today, I said, there's something about those end-of-life experiences within a family. Having been there as a nurse and now as a daughter, that is very similar to me within the health of the family to a birth story. When women and when mothers and fathers, if we listen to fathers, they have a birth story. They all have a birth story, and they like to tell them. and it's part of what creates who they are. There are things about the end of life stories for families that are very important as well, and I'm not sure that we listen to them. I'm not sure that we call them out because it's a little maybe something that we don't like to talk about. But we, my family, there was my siblings and my mother all together with my dad in the last week, and we still tell pieces of that story to each other. We pull it out and we examine a little bit and then put it back, but it's part of who we are, and it's part of that ongoing family life and health, and it's important for us to and what was really difficult for us was we had a brother in Missouri, the big strapping brother, who was not there, and we could see this was not going to go the way that we all, and that it had gone many times before for us. My dad had emphysema, and he would get pneumonia and be hospitalized and then get pulled out of it with the antibiotics, but this time it was not going to happen, and so I got on the phone and said, Les, you better come. I think you better come. And we were, that was our nervousness that he wasn't going to get there, but he did. So anyway, so being together is important. And if that person isn't there, like none of the spouses can share this because they just weren't there. It's just, but it was okay. It was our story. So.
And when you talk about that, the ability to be connected, I've seen many patients who will hang on yep. and continue to live until that one bit of business gets finished or that one person that they want to see comes in the door. So it's amazing how that can occur. And I think it's through these end-of-life experiences that you really bring together faith, hope, and courage, and a sense of connectedness in families. And it helps give greater meaning and purpose to God. Here's a little story from an AIDS client that I worked with in Billings, Montana. We need God. We need to have God exist. There is nothing without God. Emptiness, terror, isolation, meaninglessness. I am truly thankful I have read Satir, even Hemingway, before now. If I thought I was the first to think or experience these ideas, I'd go mad. I am sometimes terrified as I look at my reality, but then I pull back. Remember God and my family, and feel a measure of safety and sense once again. And then I force myself to refuse looking into that awfulness again. I cannot bear more than a glimpse. So really, as he was able to go to the end of life, he really continued to focus on the purpose of God and the meaning. Matthew 25, verses 31 through 40. Do you want to read that, Sonia?
Sure. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him. And he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will come, will say to those at his right hand, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these, who are members of my family, who did it to me.
So, if you reflect on that passage, what shall I become, a sheep or a goat? And I think that choice really loops back into what is your hope at the end of life? And as Christians, our expectation is that we're going to share our inheritance with those in need. And by doing that type of service, we experience joy giving in that service. A lot of times there's mutual blessings. I think I get a lot more from my patients and families than maybe I even can ever give to them. But you must ask yourself, well, who are the hungry and thirsty in your life, in your family? In what ways do you care for them? Who are the strangers that are in need? And what happens when you are the needy person? I think there's a lot of different ways that Christian community and grace gets operationalized in various gifts of forgiveness, the ability to release and find peace at the end of life. Some strategies that you can use to help with the gifts of grace at end of life is just accompanying the person. And as they travel the path, it switches. Some days people are very calm and comfortable with their end of life, and maybe a couple hours later, they're in a little different state of mind. So being able to travel and just accompany them and listen to where they're at. Trying to be empathetic is a strategy when somebody's going through that dying process. Allow them to share their spiritual thoughts. A lot of times people want to talk about it, but nobody ever opens it up to be a conversation in the room or with a large group of family members. Prayer is a strategy that you can use as a family to help with the gifts of grace. You talk about different reading from the Bible, but you can also use songs or tapes or anything that has meaning or inspirational reading sometimes people like. I remember a little child who was dying from cancer, and she liked to have the little children's songs played. So as she was dying in my girlfriend's arms, we always made sure that we were playing those songs for her. Healing rituals are also important at the end of life, because even though the physical healing isn't occurring, you still carry on with those healing rituals to make sure that the person can heal emotionally and spiritually at the end of life. I think it's troubling at the end of life, and some of God's greatest gifts are shared and revealed during that pivotal time in a person's life history. And one story I'd like to share a little bit is we had a man who was diagnosed with GI cancer, and it spread very fast. It was in his liver, pancreas, colon. He was an alcoholic and had a history of pancreatitis, which turned to cancer and then spread through the GI tract. And he was one of those guys who was hanging on. He was estranged from his one daughter, Liz. And finally, Liz showed up. And
this happens a lot in healthcare situations. I'm like, oh, okay.
Liz finally showed up one day, and she sang two songs to her daughter, her dad. That song, Daddy's Hands, and then Amazing Grace, and then he died. And it's these times when you feel totally helpless that sometimes you can do your best caregiving, you as family members and us as nurses. My neighbor Myrtle died. She was 92 years old, had severe congestive heart failure, was on the farm all her life, and you couldn't get her off the farm. So she wanted to stay there as she was going through the dying process. And it was very curious, because we were sitting there and her son was present, and she goes, do you see all those people? And her son said, oh, who's there? And she started naming off people that she was saw coming towards her, and she died sitting up in her chair, knowing that all the people had come to her and she went with them.
I'm going to give you just a little added story about when my dad died. We were all around the bed, and this was before he slipped into a coma, so he was still talking. He was singing to my mother, which just had never happened. My dad was a very stoic Norwegian man, and started singing the song from their dating days to her, which was just fun as ever. But then my brothers, we were all there, and he just looked right up at my brother, and he said, I wonder what he looks like. And we just, you know, we all thought, oh my, no, he's losing it, you know, and he's... But as we began to process that afterwards, like, he was talking about Jesus. That's what he was talking about. I wonder what he looks like. And then the pastor had come in right at, you know, not too long after that, and he said, well, hi, Earl. How are you doing? And my dad just pointed, go there. Like, okay. And when my dad decided something, that was it, you know. And so he did. He did, but it is interesting when you hear, you know, it's our gift as family members to hear those assurances and how important those assurances are at the end of life. It's strengthening to one's faith as a family member, as a daughter.
What can you say about having experience with the death of dementia patients where they're just incommunicado?
Yeah.
How do you try to communicate with them? Does it depend on the individual situation? What have you done? What have you seen? I'm sure the family, from what you say, it's real important that the family talk among themselves, but dealing with the patient herself or himself.
I think it's difficult with Alzheimer's patient, but I don't know what Sonia believes, but I believe that a person's hearing is the last sense to go, so I always continue to talk, even though I know Alzheimer's patients can't always make connections, but I would say about 85% of the Alzheimer's patients that I've been with at the end of life have some clarity.
Yeah.
There's a clarity that comes some point before they die that is
new and different than it's been for maybe 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Or however long they've had that disease as they were progressing through the severe dementia. And it's very nice when the family can see that and be present when that clearing occurs, because it gives them that last essence of hope, and that's what they really hang on to. And didn't we even hear that with Reagan? I think when they talked about his dying,
he looked at Nancy.
Yeah, he had a
connection. Like he knew her. Oh, really? Yeah. I that is my experience as well, and I have much more experience with children than with adults at the end of life. And of course, kids get into those comatose states as well, but in dementia, I probably my experience is more of having acquaintances whose parents have died and having those dementia experiences, and there is an uncanny experience at the end of life for I would say about 85%. I mean, that's a good percentage because I think it's pretty high, where there's some memory that comes forth and some. Sometimes it's a look, or it might be an utterance of something about a memory of a family experience that is, wow. And I you know, I think that happens quite often. So it's such a mystery. Alzheimer's is such a mystery, really.
At the end of life, typically you use a. I do in my practice a lot of touch and therapeutic touch and those type of things. But with Alzheimer's clients, you have to be very careful with that because sometimes it stimulates and is more upsetting. So with Alzheimer's clients, sometimes you can't use that ability to communicate that human touch because it becomes aggravating for them. So that's a different death a little bit than typical.
You mean even like holding their hand or so?
Yeah, sometimes just the tactile stimulation gets them agitated.
Oh. And it may be.
You see the aggravation is pretty negative.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that would look like.
I would say it's more negative in what my image is of trying to help somebody die. I really don't want them to be wrestling and those type of things. So trying to help keep them more calm as they pass over, I guess. Maybe that's just my own image as to what I see or how I interpret a good death versus a bad death. And I've seen bad deaths. My first training, I'm on the ambulance crew, and my first death is a decapitation.
Jeez.
That's a bad death. then so all these, and I've had two friends who have been murdered. Those are bad deaths. When you deal with suicide clients, those are bad deaths. So as you look at the continuum of bad and good deaths, I think I try to help people be more calm, peace-like, comfortable.
An image that I like to use is of a midwife in assisting someone to die, like I would assisting someone to be born. That there are ways in which I can create an environment that is more comforting. And it may be touch, isn't it? Maybe it's sound, maybe it's smell. There may be something that's much more kind and good feeling that I could do.
I think coming into that situation is allowing yourself to have the tables turned on you too. So as a pastor, I'll come in sometimes expecting and minister to this family in this situation, all of a sudden it's
coming back
to you. You know, on internship there was a elderly bachelor. He's living in Farmington, Minnesota, which is the outer ring suburb of the Twin Cities. And he was a trapper on the Vermilion River, lived in a little shack. He had his knees were shot, his hips were shot, because he never owned a car. He just walked the Vermilion River checking his traps. And so people from the church would get his chair and put it out in the middle of his garden, and he'd sit there and hoe and drag it. I mean, you talk about will. This guy had will. And I remember when he died, that was the first funeral I helped with. And before he died, he said, when I walked the river, he talked about some old guy that set traps. He said, he used a modern technique. He'd leave an old Budweiser can sit by the edge so he knew that there was a trap. Most people thought it was garbage. So he said, there was always a sign I could see where the traps were because somebody's gone before me. He said, and there's nothing I'm going to experience in life or death where Jesus hasn't gone before me, including death. He's been there. And he tells me, don't be afraid of it. And he wasn't afraid. So... So he's giving me all this stuff, and I'm trying to...
The young punk.
You have to be willing to let them minister to you, too, you know, in that situation.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, in a way, you know, end of life is the ultimate grace, because it is the end, and whatever you did, whether it was right or wrong, you know, in caring for someone, you know, it doesn't matter to them anymore, you know? And so... You know, there's a sense in which you've got to work to release that for yourself, and that's the grace too, you know, because, you know, just talking about the dementia, you know, I mean, or even with drugs, you know, at some point, you know, you don't know anymore whether they want to be touched or not, or whether anything's getting through, you know, or not. At one point, my mom said, stop helping me, go to bed, you know, she, you know, and I realized this is her death.
There's a lot... to that, you know, as a nurse, I had forever thought, well, they want, someone should be there, someone should be there. But when my dad died, nobody was there.
Right.
And that was okay, because he was an independent guy all his life. And he just kept going, going, going. And then we went home because we were exhausted, and he died 20 minutes after we left.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I've never felt bad about that, because I know that's probably how it was supposed to happen. He wasn't, you know, he was a tough bird, so that was, you know, he wasn't gonna be doing this with us around, you know. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, and you're right. I think we do what the Spirit leads us to do.
I had that moment of helplessness that I figure mothers must have with newborn infants who can't tell them what they need, what they want. I mean, it was just terrifying, you know?
Right.
You know, does she want her head stroked, or is that bugging the heck out of her? She just can't tell me, you know? But finally, the grace is, you know, it doesn't matter.
Do you want to do the five rites?
I'm going to do this. We do have...
I can end up when you can.
Okay. Oh, gosh. Well, I guess we won't do it very long. The five wishes are... many of you have already done this. Some of you may or may not have looked at the five wishes that let families and healthcare providers know what you want and how you want to be treated if you're seriously ill or unable to speak for yourself. And there's a website written here on the five wishes from Aging with Dignity. I recommend that website. If you have not created a document for your family and healthcare providers, that will answer these five questions. Which person do I want to make decisions for me? Should I not be able to do that? What kind of medical treatment do I want, and what kind of treatments do I want? What kind of treatment, medical treatments and treatment, how comfortable do I want to be? That may have to do with, I want to be pain-free, sedated out, I want to be alert, I want to be able to interact, that kind of thing. How do I want people to treat me, and what do I want my loved ones to know? And there are some important things about that. From the healthcare provider perspective, I know that when some of those things are clear, it's much easier for families to make decisions. I'm just doing a research project in critical care, and was there in that situation when a family whose mother had emphysema, just like my dad had COPD, and the mother at a time, the patient at a very lucid moment had discussed with her family how she did not want to die. She did not want to go on a ventilator. She did not want heroic measures to be utilized. And she happened to be out east, from out east and home in Minnesota for a high school graduation. She got sick. And this happened to be her home, and so she kind of came home. And so the family then, in critical care, as the physician is asking them now the next step, I need to know, do I put her on a respirator or do I not? And the family unanimously said, no, she doesn't want that to happen. So because of that, they felt really good and okay about having made the decision not to put her on the ventilator, to take her out of critical care into a quieter, more kind place for her to die. And so when you've made those decisions, it's very helpful. The 10 things that families should expect about end-of-life care are our messages to you as nurses. These are the things we think you should advocate for your family member at the end of life, and or create. Respect for dignity of the patient, the client and family. Respect for the wishes of the client and family. Control of symptoms, whatever they are. Nausea, pain, anorexia, which is not wanting to eat, and so maybe finding the kinds of things that are going to be workable. Confusion. There are medications that can be helpful and can be harmful in all of those situations. So working with your healthcare provider, you can strike a delicate balance. Shifting a perspective from cure to to comfort. I think we've lost them. Is this the end of
No more taping.
Is this a sign? It's going dark. Coordination of care to maximize quality of life, a holistic perspective for the family, an invitation from us to you to be involved, access to any therapy that will improve quality of life, including alternative and non-traditional treatments that I only see as accentuating traditional medical care, whether that be, I mean, it might be aromatherapy or massage or music or whatever it might be that will enhance that. Care from a multidisciplinary team. The hospice movement is the absolutely most wonderful model of that kind of care that I know of. The hospice movement has done a wonderful job of providing interdisciplinary holistic care. And then clear attention to spiritual care and meaning making at the end of life. So those are the things we'd like to share for you to advocate for. Did you have a thought? Oh, okay. You took a breath and then okay.
Would you please join us in prayer? Sitting humbly amidst his followers on a Galilean hillside, he taught of compassionate caregiving, the carpenter of Nazareth, the Lamb of God, the Savior of our world, who promised, whatever you do for the least ones, you do for me. His lesson is so simple, his message so caring. Give some food to those who are hungry, give some drink to those who are thirsty, welcome strangers, dress people who need clothes, visit your brothers and sisters who can't get out, and take care of the sick. It is our hope and desire that the God of all people provide you the skills, gifts, courage, love, and grace to move forth and discern what it means to be a Christian family. Summon out what we shall be as Christian families who take time for one another. Take us as we are, disabled and healthy or chronically ill, and set your seal upon our broken heart to assist in the support families throughout the cancer experience. And finally, please help families experience the gifts of grace and peace at the end of life. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for a great week.